Hello, my name is Sophie Scott.
And I am Will Eaves.
And together we are the New Romantics. I'm a neuroscientist.
I'm a writer and poet, kind of, occasionally a musician.
And what we do in the New Romantics, if we can remember what we do, we, for various complicated life reasons, it's been a while since we last recorded anything, is I give Will a paper to read and he gives me a short story or a book or some poems to read. I have to say I get the better end of this deal, I think. And then we try and make sense. Well, normally what happens is Will has much better ideas about the scientific papers than many of the scientists. Well, but let's find out.
We may be bucking a trend today because the paper that Sophie's given me that we've been looking at is called Evolution of Reading and Face Circuits During the First 3 Years of Reading Acquisition. And I struggled with this. In fact, I felt my eyes moving over the surface of the page. And rather than reading acquisition, it felt like reading loss. I didn't necessarily understand what was being said to me. But it is very interesting, and Sophie's now going to say a little bit about it.
So the paper that I sent Will is trying to look at what's happening in your brain as you're developing the ability to, you know, as your brain is changing rapidly over the first few years of life. And one of the things that is really weird about brains is that you have, it's comprised of about 86 billion brain cells, neurons, and you're born with almost all of them. So what happens in development is those brain cells are growing and changing and making connections with other brain cells, but you're not growing new bits of brain. And that means that anything that happens in terms of development is growth and change within those individual brain cells. So
and the connections between
and
them.
Exactly, and critically, the connections between them. And what they're trying to do in this paper is actually tackle a specific hypothesis of the lab that says that what happens when we learn to read is that we don't develop a whole new brain region to do this. What we do is we use brain regions that are already developing a specialization for some visual processing. And their theory is that that visual specialization is for faces. So when you learn to recognize faces and you learn to read, those are two different processes in that no one has to teach you to recognize faces. Human babies are born caring about faces. They pay a lot of attention to faces. And they're arguably one of the most important sources of social information out there. So we... that, you know, there's a good evolutionary reason why this would be something that it would be important to care about. We're almost certainly not the only animal that does this. Maybe that's something we'll come back to. But it is not that common to be as interested in, to be able to pull information out from faces in a way that means, for example, you can recognise people. So your dog knows who you are, but it's not doing that by knowing what your face looks like. It's doing that by your whole body and your smell. We're doing it largely with faces. And for many, many years, the sort of parallel development of something like how we learn to read, people thought, well, there are brain areas that are specialised for reading, but that can't be the case because it's too recent in an evolutionary sense for our brains to have developed, you know, kind of our brains to have become fundamentally different because we read. And reading is an invention. It seems to have been invented several times throughout human history, and it's just all too recent for there to have been any kind of positive evolutionary kind of shaping as a result of this. You either come down, therefore, to saying, well, when you read words, there's nothing special about it at all. You're just using the brain regions you use for recognising stuff in the world. And there are people who would argue this. And Dehaene's lab have always been more along the line of it's specialised for reading. There's a specialised brain region. But they've developed that out into something that says, rather more generally, it's specialised for reading, but it's able to do so because it was originally specialised to do something else, and that's faces.
So the terminology, I think, or the term that the authors of this article use for that, or the verb that comes up a few times, and is recruiting. We should mention the authors. They are Zhao Zhao Feng, Carla Monsalvo, Stanislav Dehaene and Ghislaine Dehaene Lamberts, all corking names, I think you'll agree. And their point is that, well, it seems to me, reading it, that your description of the paper as a whole is very, very clear, Sophie, but what's not so clear to me is whether the reading acquisition is a question of the learning child recruiting bits of the brain that are already established as being evolutionarily important for facial recognition, or whether they are, and this is what they don't go into quite so much, or whether they're recruiting bits of the brain that aren't yet committed to any particular skill or task. I found that quite difficult to, surely there must be some mechanism for deciding which it is.
If I was going to be a little bit unfair and try and sort of hypothesise about what's going on without having been somebody who's part of this study, because what they do is they scan children who are learning to read, and they scan them at different ages, so they're acquiring that skill, and they're also they also scan them when they're looking at faces. So I suspect what they thought was that face processing won't change very much because you're already pretty good at it. They're doing children at the age of six because that's when you learn to read in France. And then they scan them multiple times. And in fact, what they find is that the face processing regions change. And then you introduce reading.
Well, it's always, I think they say that the face processing recognition, you know, dynamic, whatever it is very, very protracted. It keeps on going. It doesn't just, you have it very early, but you keep on having it. And that's quite an interesting thing, that you don't, it's not a skill that's just sort of set in aspic. You have to constantly reinvent it, I think.
I think they probably thought that was going to be a bit more constant, and what you'd see is now we introduce reading and we're seeing a subset of that getting changed by reading, because that would be one interpretation of the harder form of their hypothesis. And, you know, the brain, go figure, it's more complex than that. So the brain is still developing a lot when you're six. Your brain signature associated with seeing faces is still changing at that age. That's probably not surprising. I think many things are not fixed in stone about the six-year-old brain. I mean, your brain in general is something that changes over.
Even though you have all the same amount of neurons?
Even though you have the same amount of neurons, and the big changes really come in when you are young, but those changes don't stop. You are able to form new connections and remodel and strengthen existing connections throughout your entire lifetime. So anything that you learn over the course of a day, anything that you remember from this very podcast, is happening because your brain's just changed again.
Yeah.
It's probably true that what we haven't done enough of with these amazing tools that let us go in and ask questions about brain structure and brain function, we haven't used that enough to look at development. We haven't looked at the changing brain very much because it's hard, and children are in school and they move about, and it's, you know, the ethics are different. You've got to do more of it to get children in. So I think there are many practical reasons. But that means that I suspect what they were going in was asking a question about development, and we just don't know enough about the developing brain in general. And what we're seeing here is that even something that seems very obvious, like faces, is still going through a great deal of change.
But the obvious thing to say from a layperson's point of view is you understand why, at least I think I can understand why facial recognition is initially so important. You've got to know who your parent is. You've got to know, you know, where you belong in the tribe.
Yeah.
You've got to know what is safe and isn't safe. But also, I think it must be something to do with the fact you've got to know what is alive and what's dead. And the point about a face is it's dynamic and it's moving. And the point about text is, unless you've got some very, very flash kind of an audiovisual display, it's generally static. At the common sense level, it makes sense that this static thing and being able to discriminate small changes in script and minor shape changes should come a bit later down the line. Or is that a naive thing to say?
I mean, it's not. And I think one of the things that's interesting, you know, their idea that you've got this brain that is, if it's specialised for anything, and it's specialised, it's not much that the human brain sort of has baked in from the outset. There's an interest in voices, but there's an interest in faces. And of course, voices you hear before you're born. So, that you know, the face really is completely new to you when you first open your eyes, and babies already care about it. So there's something very interesting right from the outset. And then all this other stuff comes in that we need to learn about. And one of the things that the human visual system does, it seems to build up information into different levels of sort of structural features. And that leads to some of the specialities about how we process information. So when you look at a face, you don't see it by just, okay, I've got a pair of eyes, and there's a nose and there's a mouth. Okay, that looks like it probably is a face. Let's see if I recognise that face. You've got much more of a sort of predictive network that's going, could that be a face? That's why we see faces in things like door handles and, you know, clouds, because there's that sort of expectation is there. But the expectation isn't built around the bits. It's built around a kind of a holistic...
Yeah.
Just gestalt.
That's the relationship of the bits to each other, actually.
Exactly,
and
exactly.
And their movement. When you're looking at a page of text, you don't have any of that gestalt. You know that they're words, but you don't... You're not, because of the nature of the word, which is, you know, an abstract sign with a meaning behind it, you only see, you will recognise it as text, but of course you don't recognise the meaning of the text. That requires further and close attention.
It is interesting, because if you look at how people move their eyes when they read, you don't read every letter in a word. You make fixations towards the start of a word. And then you're pulling that information out. So you're using the kind of lower level, what are the bits of the letters, but you're also using, because of the way vision works, you only get really good visual resolution very close to where you're actually looking. We read left to right. So in fact, when you're reading, you are pulling out information about the stuff you're directly looking at, but you're also pulling out information about the upcoming stuff on the right, about the upcoming words, because you use that partly to know about what they are, but also use that to guide when you next move your eyes to.
Yeah, interesting.
So you've got this interesting pattern, as you see in face processing, of the details being processed. So when I look at you, I'm looking at your eyes. And in fact, if I lip read you, I would still look at your eyes to be following what you were saying. Mm. And that's because even though your mouth is some distance away from where I've got the good visual acuity, I've still got enough acuity that I can be pulling out that information in parallel.
Yeah.
So you've got the kind of fine stuff and the coarser, gestalty stuff always happening in face processing, and that's transferable directly to learning to read. It seems that, you know, you've got the structural information you need to decode.
It's like inductive reasoning, actually, isn't it? You know, you don't need every last bit of the puzzle
exactly.
In order to be able to kind of get to the next stage of the logical argument.
Yeah.
And that's a very good description of what's going on when you're reading it, and its relationship to scanning a face and concentration on, you know, how looking at holding attention in one area of the eyes can still give you a vestigial sense of what's happening elsewhere. But I still maintain that looking at a page of text is a bit different. When you look at things that are comparable in one way to text, like a musical score, now, this is, as it were, at a later stage of reading when you know what musical notation is. But for those people who do, it's possible to look at a score in general and get quite a good gestalt sense of what period the score belongs to very, very quickly without going into the details of what the melody is. They can see the way the layers work and move and say, OK, that's counterpoint. It has to be 17th century. It's probably Bach or School of Bach. And similarly with a narrative painting, you know, without getting into the brushwork, you know, you can see who the major mythological figures are. That's not all prior knowledge being recruited. It's not all narrative and semantic knowledge.
Yeah.
It's to do with the way you get things at a glance.
And that's true. So again, if you go back to where we move our eyes to when we read across text, you jump your eyes ahead to the next word, and you have to, quite a lot of planning is happening. Most of the time when you're reading, you're actually planning where your eyes are moving to next. What you don't do is move your eyes to function words. So on, the, of, ah. You don't move your eye, you're moving your eye to the next content word, because that's where you need the detail.
Interesting.
And that's, so it's definitely, you do still need to get to the detail. It's also true that, you know, a page of text is different from, here is a class of children's faces. There's many levels at which it's not the same, but if you take a very basic visual input argument, you can see how you could be repurposing these more abstract skills that the visual system has for pulling out kinds of information, and writing parasitizes upon that really well. It exploits it very well. So you don't need to hypothesize some whole new extra thing happening, or say that reading text is like doing anything, just like any visual processing, you could see how that could be something that actually gets pulled out in a more specific way.
Are we talking in general here, really, about brain plasticity? Or is that a different thing?
No, that's very much exactly what we're talking about. So it's, I mean, it's difficult because once you've learnt it, it can be such an automatic skill, and it becomes so kind of, people use the phrase kind of hardwired. It doesn't mean to say you were born with it, but it is like so overlearned that it can be very hard to not do it. So if you are a skilled reader and somebody puts a word in front of you, you'll have to read that word. You can't not read it. The great worlds of advertising are based on this exact principle. And that's the power of automatic processing. You can't turn that off. You can't, once you've got it, it's very, very hard. And in fact, normally the only thing that could turn that off is if you have a head injury, something that affects that. And then suddenly, I mean, I've worked with patients who have very selective patterns of damage that mean they are word blind. They cannot read words. They might be able to tell you what the letters are, but they can't build it up into a word.
And that's presumably that's a consequence both of damage, but also of being an adult.
Exactly.
Because once you're an adult, certain things are kind of, plasticity is, in that for that particular skill, reading acquisition is diminished.
It's going to be very, very hard to relearn that. And that's partly because, yes, you say, these skills that you develop when you're a child, when your brain is changing with phenomenal speed. And also, you don't do much else. You're pretty much just learning about the world as a child. You never have that time again to sort of devote to learning to read. So somebody who's word blind, they would also struggle to name individual letters. They might be able to tell you what certain words are based on their shape. So I remember one patient could tell you the words ladies and gentlemen because that's what gets written on toilets. Mm. And you need to be able to tell the difference between those. And he was getting them from the shape.
Yeah.
They look different as a shape of the word. But that guy could also do, he did all home accounting. He was absolutely fine with digits. So you think, what? So written down numbers are not stored in the brain where letters are. They're not, because you use them for different purposes. Mm. We don't read numbers for meaning.
No, well, this is the thing, because your example of the person who partially began to reacquire reading sense from the signs on toilets and letters on toilets and L and G is an interesting example of someone bringing meaning to a letter, not the other way around. The struggle to learn to read, it's not necessarily a struggle, is what do these signs on the page refer to? What is this strange abstract thing? Mm. What does it indicate in the real world, or at least the world of concepts? But there, in the brain damaged person, it's the other way around. They know the meaning, you know, of toilets and sort of, you know, sex allocated toilets, but they then port that back into the letter.
Yeah, how can I use this? Because I know they have to be different, and I know I need to get it right.
And I know that we were talking, this is where we come on to creatures other than humans, because this is an interesting thing. Sophie and I have talked about this quite a lot, because there's quite a lot of, you might call it niche literature, but it's very interesting, both in the world of comparative psychology, but also in literature, that asks the question whether certain animals have something like an ability to recognise letters, or even a reading function. There are rat catchers in New York who maintain that rats, there are some rats, very intelligent creatures, by the way, these rodents, that, quotes, know how to read. Now, they don't know, it's pretty certain they don't know how to read. They're not doing something that, they're not looking for what we would regard as the semantic meaning behind a word. But the point is, they are recognising a shape.
Mm.
And they are attaching it to actually a different set of meanings, like food.
Or danger. You
know, or danger.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there is some kind of rudimentary knitting together of concept and sign. You know, Locke said, famously John Locke said, a word is a sign of an idea.
Yeah.
And if a rat can see a danger sign and know that it means there's a sort of tripwire or, you know, electricity, then that is reading, isn't it?
Well, I suppose the thing that's interesting about reading and why you wouldn't call that chap I worked with who was word blind but could tell the ladies and the gents' toilets is that it didn't generalise, he couldn't do something else with that.
No.
And I think what we use as a definition of like skill in learning to read is being able to read new words. And that's something that means that you've learnt that skill and you're able to then kind of put that together generatively at some level to then help you interpret something you might never have seen before. And of course the same is true for how we process faces. You're not completely flawed when you encounter a face you haven't seen before. You learn that face, you know, so the kind of flexibility of mapping there remains.
And that happens when you look at a foreign language which you don't actually speak, when you can't write. You will quite often know enough to be able to make a guess at the way the words sound.
Yeah.
You know, so you will have the phonemes.
Yeah.
I don't speak German, but I can make a pretty good guess at how most of the words actually sound. Because I've heard it, and it's like imitating a call. There's something very, very primitive locked in there about the sound of the word and the sound of the voice saying it as opposed to what it means.
There's some Italian TV show from the 1970s where somebody sings a song and the song is sung entirely
gibberish English.
Yeah, what English sounds like if you're Italian and you don't speak it. So yeah. Exactly. No, totally.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, we'll put that in the notes.
Yes, it's a 60s song. It's very funny. And it sounds, the weird thing about it is it sounds like a kind of Gilbert and Sullivan patter song.
Yes.
Because it's going so fast.
It sort of feels, to my ear, it feels like I should understand it. I can't, you know, my ear keeps going.
It's rather a good song, too. Yes.
No, yeah, it's not
I know exactly the one. There's a video and there's a lot of sort of 60s women sort of gyrating on platforms. It's absolutely great. I think all reading lessons should be like that.
Yes.
If you're six. It'd be marvellous. Imagine.
So the other thing that's interesting about faces and the ability to process faces, and I think this also leads us on to differences with humans and other animals. Like I said, humans are good at recognising animals, ourselves, from our faces. Not all animals necessarily do that. As I say, dogs are primarily recognising other dogs by the smell and the overall appearance rather than is what the face looks like. The thing that's quite striking about humans is we can also tell other animals about apart based on their faces, and very few other animals can do that.
Do we absolutely know that?
Our best guess seems to be that the animals who can do that, who can recognise other species based on their face, are corvids.
I was about to say crows,
That's interesting because they're the other animals where you also find use of shared attention. So shared attention is when you know, I'm looking at Will right now and I might cast my eye to one side to glare at the people outside who are doing building work. I apologise if this is spoiling your enjoyment of the programme. But that's, you know, if Will were to look where I was looking, that would be an example of shared attention. It's very, very common. We point at things, we look at things to get somebody to, here's that thing I'm interested in. Most animals can't understand that. Some animals that seem to have been very closely associated with humans, we seem to have picked, possibly even kind of encouraged that in their evolution. So dogs understand shared attention. But the other animal way...
But I think to a very limited degree in some species better than others.
Definitely variation there. So hunting dogs, pointers, that's a classic example of it. What you find in corvids, like crows, is an understanding of shared attention and joint attention. And what it means to look at something that's not been trained by being around humans or selected for by humans. It has evolved completely separately. And it's interesting, if you watch two crows sort of having a conversation and you go and look at them, they'll give you a look at you back and then they'll probably just move along a bit. Like, I don't know what her deal is, but she's paying too much attention to us. And it's not because they think you're going to predate on it. They know what it means to look at and sort of pay attention to something. They also know what it means to hide something.
Yes.
You know, so that there's a real concept of the meaningfulness of being able to see or to not see something. And they also seem to have this understanding of being able to recognise humans from their faces, presumably other animals as well, but we're humans, so we're allowed to prioritise that. But they also will behave differently to you. They remember you. So if you've behaved unpleasantly to a corvid, they will remember you based on your face. And they will also tell other corvids about you. who will then give you a wider
They do
birth.
Befriend as well, also. Yes. It's absolutely the case. They befriend young children. I don't know if that's something to do with brain capacity, that there's a comparable... There's now, in the wonder of the web, quite a... I mean, it's a remarkable amount of sort of video material of corvids with young children or babies coming to visit them.
And giving presents.
Yeah.
They give presents. They bring trinkets. Now, they're small things that can be carried by a corvid, so they don't bring you, here's a guitar, you know.
Yeah.
But it's quite interesting. They bring shiny things, bright things, things they think humans will like, and they'll bring them, often to say... People have hypothesised, scientists have hypothesised that it's behavioural learning, that they've kind of learned, well, if I bring this thing, I get fed. But that doesn't seem to work because they're already being fed. They're bringing the thing to somebody who's already feeding
them. I think there's something one might say, giving someone something in order to be fed would be a straight down the line behavioural reason for doing it. But I think there is a conceptual thing going on here as well. And one of the concepts that's maybe behind both that kind of gift-giving behaviour, but also their well-attested ability to count, you know, putting stones into a pot, as the fable has it, I think is that it may not be so much counting as we understand it in terms of quantity, although corvids do seem to know the number of young they have in the way other birds don't, but the fact that the concept they're aware of is here and not here. The hiding thing you were mentioning, putting a stone in a receptacle. They're good tool makers, they're doing it for a reason. They may be raising the water level. But they're also, there's another, if you like, more abstract concept going on. They know the difference between present and not present.
Yeah, it is quite extraordinary. This is an anecdote, not data. There was a guy in the US who described finding pine twigs really finely threaded with the pulls from cans of drink. And he kept finding them on his doorstep. And in the end, he realised it was crows, that he was feeding the crows. So they'd gone to quite a lot of trouble to make something for him.
Yeah, yeah.
It was, and it's the numbers are sort of conceptual leaps within that. Like, this is more than just, oh, I've bought you a shiny thing. There's a, so you like stuff that's made with other stuff. I can do that.
I read a fascinating paper by a geologist speculating about, you know, what will happen when humans sort of go the way of every species and die out, and what would be the successor species if, you know, if the planet was still habitable. And their bet was on two of the creatures we've mentioned, either rats or corvids, that they would be a kind of baseline for complex evolution.
And certainly Nikki Clayton, who runs the Corvid Research Centre in Cambridge, has argued that if it wasn't for the fact that primates emerged as the sort of all-conquering heroes that they currently occupy on Earth, that it would have been corvids. Because the rats are very clever. They are not tool users.
They're not
the
tool makers, no. Yeah. They'd have to kind of develop in some way in a cave and sort of produce arms or something. Oh, let's not think about it. It's so horrible. But the notion of these creatures being at the beginning of some sort of, you know, further evolutionary or creative process is kind of brings us on quite nicely to the poems that I gave by three authors. In fact, most of them are poems from a very famous sequence by Ted Hughes called Crow, which he wrote in 1970. I think published in 1971. And the two other authors are, there's a poem by Elizabeth Bishop called Sandpiper. It's one of my favourite poems. And a poem by Sylvia Plath, famously the wife of Ted Hughes, who took her own life in 1963. And the poem's called The Zookeeper's Wife. And all these different poems express a different set of relationships of the human to the animal world. But Crow is fascinating. It's a full-on creation myth, really. It's got elements of very ancient epic in it, of Babylonian epic, of the Song of Songs from the Bible, all those wonderful incantatory qualities that you get in those ancient poems where lines are repeated, names are repeated. Oh, little blood, you know, God made crow and it was so-and-so, God made this, God made that. And I think Hughes was attempting a grand... It's a very, very 60s prog rock era synthesis, really, of these spiritual traditions and poetic traditions, repetition, incantation, the Bible, the green man, and the figure who holds it all together is Crow, this black, shadowy sort of shamanic entity that traffics between the human world and the spiritual world and the divine world and brings back stories from the myth. I mean, it really is, the thing it makes me, reminds me of most of all is there's a fantastic Babylonian poem called Inanna's Journey into Hell, roughly coeval with the first major epic that we know of called the Epic of Gilgamesh. And it's a precursor version of the Persephone myth, in which, you know, people go to the underworld in order to sort of, you know, bring back daylight and the sort of new seasons and growth. But there are all these repetitive incantatory motifs where Inanna, who goes to hell to see her hellish queen sister Ereshkigal, has to take off all her clothes and then has to divest herself of her flesh because, of course, she's died.
Yeah.
And so it's about death and decomposition. And that is exactly the tenor of Crow. It seems to be. If I just read you a tiny bit of it, the very opening, you know, two legends. Black was the without eye, black the within tongue, black was the heart, black the liver, black the lungs. And all, as much as you're getting some kind of repetitive evocation of the bird, the animal, you're also listening to a sort of prophet. There's a very high-level prophetic figure involved here, the narrator, Hughes himself perhaps, invoking this world. And that's the thing with creation myths. It's one thing to talk about the crows and the birds and the bees and the flowers and the vegetal world and humans and to look at the vast panoply of creation. But it's nothing to name it. It's nothing to give it a name, to give it something that's legible, that you can read. So there are always two elements, really, to a creation myth, which is the world created and then naming what you can see.
Mm.
It's not necessarily you have to read it, but it has to have a name, you know, that you recognise in some way. And then the third thing, which is what I think Hughes is really interested in, is that to name is also to create.
One of the things that's very basic to humans, and it's so basic we don't notice that we do it, but naming things is incredibly important to us. To identify things in the world and to give them names is what we do, particularly for the visual world. I can think of very few things in this room I can see right now that I couldn't tell you the name of. Mm. It's what we do. It's how we describe and kind of understand and get power over and make sense of the world is by what are the things in it? What are their names? And when we develop specializations, like we become a tea taster or a medic, we learn new words that let us break down the world into another kind of level of analysis that we need to be able to do to taste tea.
And that's why it's so disturbing when you lose the names for things, because it's when someone with dementia loses the name for chair, carpet, wall, clock. It's not just that they've lost the name, they've lost the thing.
There's a really horrible, I mean, no dementia would I wish on my worst enemy, but there's a really unpleasant disease, and it's less common form of dementia, but it can give you very focal problems. And there's something called semantic dementia, where, do not panic if you have problems remembering words, okay? Everybody has problems remembering words. In semantic dementia, people start to have problems understanding what words mean, but they can do the right thing. So if they're at the breakfast table, you might say, could you pass the marmalade? And they go, marmalade? What's marmalade? But if you gave them a jar of marmalade, they wouldn't rub it in their hair.
Interesting.
And they understand that it's a noun. And then as the disease progresses, it sort of starts with a very pure loss of the meaning of words. And as it spreads, you start to lose all your wider knowledge about that thing, as such that it's just gone. So if you ask people to copy a picture, where you show them the picture and then you take the picture away, people initially can draw the picture quite accurately, but the longer the disease has progressed, the more they'll just start drawing some generic animal. So you can show them a swan, and then they'll remember, they're not copying the picture, they're drawing it from memory. Initially, they can draw you back a picture of a swan, and then as the disease progresses, they start adding four legs onto the swan because they don't remember it's a swan, they remember it's an animal, and animals often have four legs. And you end up with your ability to understand this sort of dissolving into a much looser semantic representation.
That is really fascinating, because in a way it describes part of the kind of phantasmagoria of these Crow poems. It's almost as if Crow is this character who has undergone some of that traumatic loss. Now, it might be, you know, it might still be the processing of the death of Sylvia Plath in Hughes's case, although I think quite a lot of, you know, feminist critics, and with some reason, would argue it's, that's, you know, he didn't care enough. But it seems to be that the Crow is trying to sort of remake the world, not in the way that we understand it, but in the way that Crow understands it.
Yeah.
The crowiness of the Crow is what these poems give to the world, or try to give to the world. And I think that comes from a sense of loss and catastrophe in the background. They are very catastrophic poems. There seems to be always at the back of them death, the, you know, erasure of the world, some kind of fiery furnace that's consumed everything. As much as they're about creating the world, it's creation that comes out of a cataclysm.
They made me feel cold, like actually cold. Yeah. They were frightening.
They are quite frightening. There are some great poems here that I do really like, or some great moments of sort of physical description. There's a little image of a crab in the water, and without saying, the wave comes over it. This is the way he phrases it, the gulfing of the crab's last prayer. That's fantastic. You can absolutely see the water collapsing over it. Although it's kind of overwritten in a way, because how do you know... That's just what happens to crabs that are in the shoreline. Why should it be the crab's last prayer? They're very overdramatic poems. Yeah. And that, I think, is where I find them quite difficult, because I'm very aware of the black, shrouded figure of, let's face it, the poet standing over it all, rather than the Crow, you know, pointing at things, rather like the romantic figure of the man on the mountaintop, you know, with the cane. And to my mind, that doesn't bring me as close to actually the created world. For all the high-flown spiritual stuff, there's a wonderful poem about God and the Crow called Crow's Playmates. Lonely Crow created the gods for playmates, but the mountain god tore free, and Crow fell back from the wall face of mountains by which he was so much lessened. And there's all this kind of sort of contest between nature spirits and the Christian God and Crow. Mm. How can I put it? It's at the level of kind of high art and rhetoric. And it doesn't necessarily bring me that close to what the world really feels or looks or tastes like, or its granular strangeness.
Yeah.
Which you absolutely do get with the Elizabeth Bishop poem Sandpiper, where the figure of the poet is almost completely absent. You know, you've got no sense of someone being a prophet and standing over it and pointing. Instead, you're absolutely with the tiny little bird on the shoreline and the maziness of the way it walks. The world is a mist, and then the world is minute and vast and clear. The tide is higher or lower. He couldn't tell you which. His beak is focused. He is preoccupied, looking for something, something, something. Poor bird, he is obsessed. The millions of grains are black, white, tan and grey, mixed with quartz grains, rose and amethyst. It's such egoless writing. She's completely taken herself away from it. And the result of it is, although it's a very plain, beautiful, rhythmic description of things with some very subtle rhyme, taking herself out means, by extension, that you're brought very, very close to the little consciousness of the bird, whatever that is, and the sandpiperiness of the sandpiper, in a way that I don't get, really, with the Crow poems, which are all very big and sort of...
Monumental,
yeah.
Dark. Can I ask a really stupid question? And I'm sure I'm allowed. I'm sure. No, and I think it probably is a very stupid question. Why do you think he made it about a crow? Why a crow?
I think because he knows that crows are intelligent. They are scavengers. They're violent, and I think that he's obsessed with death and renewal. And I think he sees the crow as an emissary of death, but also something born from it. The crow is, if you like, the British version of the phoenix. I think that's kind of what Hughes felt the crow was. The crow is a figure in a lot of poems. The crow is... Corvids are very important in... They're portents.
Yeah.
Okay, they're omens of something monstrous. But they're also things that signify something else is possible. So there's a fantastic line in Macbeth. In fact, it's one of my favourite lines in all of British poetry, where pretty certain it's Banquo who says, "Light thickens and the crow makes wing to the rooky wood." So much that's brilliant about that. But he's describing a crow's flight through falling darkness and two species, the fact that the wood is full of rooks. But rooky wood as a sound belongs both to rook and the cawing of the crow. So it's a sort of vocal chant as well as a description. And so crows are very, very important in British poetry. They're very, very important in the canon. So he's choosing something that is a portent of disaster, but something that comes out of a tradition of poetry.
Right. There's also something sort of terrible about birds. Like, they're beautiful and amazing, and I like birds. They are endlessly fascinating. And there are many points at which you get this convergent evolution, so they're often vocal learners like us, and they sing songs like us, although they sing for completely different reasons, and they make sounds totally differently from us. And then you get these jarring differences. You know, our babies are all cute. What we think of as cute is basically extremely childlike, infant-like things that provoke us to want to look after four placental mammals. So the sort of, you know, the softness, fluffiness, roundness of babies and puppies and kittens, that's something very easily accessed to us as a sort of, that's a cute thing. And baby birds look absolutely terrifying. Because they've got a completely different breed. They've come from a totally different route. They are cared for by their parents, and in a way that sort of provokes something appalling in us.
Yes, they're repulsive. They're often
absolutely
repellent.
Absolutely horrible.
Water birds tend to be cute quite quickly, but that's because they just are. And I think it's because they have to fend for themselves very, very quickly.
They're not protected away in a nest.
They're set on the water rails. They're out on the water very, very, very swiftly.
Yeah.
You know, after I think it's a few days.
Yeah.
Whereas, nest-bound birds, they look repulsive. They're still covered in shreds of stuff, and they're wet and bedraggled.
But they're pointy, and they've got sharp bits and hairlessness.
They're repulsive.
Featherless. Yeah.
Well, they're taboo. I think that a lot of the myths of devastating winged creatures, you know, they might be some kind of folk memory of, I don't know, airborne predators, or some very, very deep DNA memory of vultures and eagles, or even, you know, pteranodons, I don't know. But I think it's to do with the lack of control we have over birds. They come out of nowhere, as it were, from the sky. And then they are gone, and we can't, unless we actually catch them, we can't control them in any way. And we can't ape them physiologically, because we can't fly.
Mm.
So they're always the figure of the thing that we absolutely know is coming, like fate, but which we can't do anything about.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's why the harpies are winged. It's interesting that all these figures of destruction, the dragon, classically, they're all winged.
Yeah.
And the wing is the anti-angel. It's the force of the thing you absolutely know spells, you know, destruction and danger, but which you can't do anything about. And just quickly, the last poem that we haven't talked about, which is Sylvia Plath's lovely poem, The Zookeeper's Wife. In a sense, actually, this is where it meets your point about the baby birds, because it's about someone being very still in their bed, dealing with a sense of being used up and suffocated and feeling as if, you know, she's like an eel and stifled, an eel at the bottom of the ocean, you know, and the sort of ridge of the sort of spine occasionally sticking through the smooth silk stocking of the body. It's a remarkable poem in which a lot of the whole zoo, all the creatures are invoked.
Mm.
And the idea that the speaker is somehow married to a zookeeper who's not really mentioned. It's a dramatization of how someone in a marriage might be in thrall to an absent person.
Yeah.
That they can't do anything about, which of course rather does describe Plath's situation at the end of her life. And both Hughes and Plath were married, were living in London, but she was separated from him. And the zookeeper presumably is Hughes. But the zookeeper is also the world, you know, the world that she can't. She doesn't want to be a part of anymore. And her only option, she feels, is this sort of terrible stillness. The lovely thing, though, is that the stillness and the horror of it all occasions this beautiful poem. And I think that's what's so powerfully moving about artists who do end up taking their lives, is that, yes, it's a tragedy, but remember, tragic heroes have great stoicism. And something amazing comes out of it anyway, which is their work. I mean, the cost is everything. It's their life. But it's somehow a necessary cost. It's not all a disaster. That's the extraordinary thing about, I think, her work.
It's quite funny.
It's quite funny.
Yeah. I love the, you wooed me with the wolf-headed fruit bats.
It's a great line, isn't it? You wooed me with the wolf-headed fruit bats, hanging from their scorched hooks in the moist fug of the small mammal house.
Perfection.
Yeah, it's great. Walking around the sort of... She even calls it, it's a zoo, but it's also an ark. You know, she's afloat. There's been, again, there's this sense of some disaster has taken place, but creation springs from it. And if you think about it, that's really what's always true of creation myths, I think, is that they always say something is possible from nothing. But in order for nothing to exist, something has to have been destroyed.
Yeah.
And nothing is a word that Hughes uses all the time. It's so interesting that reading doesn't come from nothing.
No.
It comes from these other areas of the brain that have already been adapted and used to sort of recognise faces, but which can be recruited anew.
And which seems to be driven by speaking. So there's an absolute mapping between writing and reading, parasitise hugely. So the brain areas take over or are involved in these facial brain areas, but the skills you use to drive that are all driven by speech and sound. So back to voices. Yeah.
Back to voices. I think that's a marvellous place to end.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Sophie. Apologies to our listeners, because it has been a very long time since we've done one of these. But
I've not been well.
Yes, we've neither of us been well.
If you aren't too cross with us for not having done this for too long, or that the background noise is too great, please do go to wherever you get your podcasts and like and review us. It would be very kind, because then that helps the algorithm and yet more people can find us. It will not be another year and a half. See you soon.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.